still pretty new at this business of performing marriages, and so we went through the entire marriage ceremony verbatim. And I said the words that I had to say, and I got to the point, do you, yes, do you, yes, and do you vow, and yes, and I said, well, then by the powers or authority vested in me by the state of Texas and in the name of God, I now pronounce you husband and wife. And I stopped because I realized I think that I just married these two people during the rehearsal. And at that moment, their eyes widened a little bit, and I think they thought the same thing. Well, we didn't say anything about that. We just didn't talk about it. So we met back the next day, and we did it for real. Said everything just the same, not a change a bit. Before that ceremony was over and everyone had gone home, the best man had forgotten to have me sign the marriage certificate or the marriage license. I had forgotten to do it. The groom had forgotten to do it, and we all went on our ways. You know, it was just a few days later, the middle of that week, I got a rather frantic telephone call wondering if, in fact, this wedding had taken place, even though it really had occurred twice, I suppose. A lot of very good memories. So much joy and excitement associated with marriage and the beginning of a new family, a new home for a new couple. And as I said, I've always been appreciative of being invited to participate. But as I think back to all of the marriage ceremonies that I've performed or been associated with, ones that I have attended and I've watched and been a witness, I recognize that always God is invited to the wedding ceremony. There are always the prayers. There is always the reading from the scriptures, thoughts put forward about what marriage is and what it entails, about what the home is to be, and what a husband and a wife ought to know as they look forward to the balance of their lives together. It's great that God is always invited to the marriage ceremony. It is unfortunate that I know in several cases, however, God was never invited into the marriage itself. The home was not built around God and an identity of being a Christian, one of God's children, or a home that is based upon Christian principles. And unfortunately, many of these families or homes that have begun through these ceremonies and so forth have not continued faithfully and with stability and strength and joy, because although God was there at the beginning, they did not seek to stay close to Him or to build that home as God would have it to be built. We often hear the term dysfunctional associated with homes. And by that, I suppose, in the simplest terms, it means or is used to designate a home that is not functioning according to some expected standard or form of normalcy. And I realize there's some subjectivity to that. But if we talk about what's truly expected and what should be right for the home, God has a view, God has a perspective. And while people may think that their homes are built well, that they are running well, that they are stable and strong, the fact is many homes are dysfunctional because they don't meet with God's design for the home. A dysfunctional home from heaven's perspective is a home that is not built upon a spiritual foundation with God at the head. We don't want such homes to be established. We don't want persons to go through such a process and arrive at some point years down the road where there is turmoil, there is strife, there is regret, there are questions of what has happened to us. So I back up just a moment and I talk about the human condition. We are human beings created in the image of God as described in Genesis chapter 1. We have faculties that God possesses. We reflect in so many ways His own abilities and powers, the ability to feel, the emotive abilities, the intellectual abilities, and the spiritual element of our constitution. And it's one of the responsibilities of humanity to know and to love the Creator. In an oft-quoted verse at the close of the book of Ecclesiastes, which, by the way, is a book that is a man's reflection from later years back upon life and its meaning and how it should be spent. King Solomon made the observation, Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. That is the purpose for our existence, to know God, to respect Him, and to love Him, to return His love. On one occasion, Jesus was asked what the greatest commandment of all was, Matthew chapter 22, beginning in verse number 37. What is the greatest commandment, or the great commandment? And Jesus very simply said, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all of thy heart, and with all of thy soul, and with all of thy mind." This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." These two principles are so foundational, so essential to anything else that life is intended to consist of, that Jesus concluded that description by saying, "Upon these two commandments hang all of the law and all of the prophets." In other words, everything else that God might ask a man or a woman to do, a person to be, is based upon or predicated upon the idea that we love our God, we know Him, and we serve Him, and that we have a right relationship with other people. That we reflect the qualities of God as we deal with people in our world. Our social relationships should show this pious or righteous quality as well, reflecting our love for God. When Paul would speak about Jesus and His descent to the earth, the purpose for which He came, of course, to offer Himself at the cross, he would say in Philippians chapter 2 and verse number 8 that Jesus, having been found in fashion as a man, humbled Himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Inherent in that statement is the idea that when Jesus took upon Himself the human form, He also shouldered the human responsibility, which is to be obedient unto God at all costs and to the fullest extent throughout all of life. And He did it so even to the most humiliating and the most degrading and the most painful death that could be imagined in His day. When we think of Jesus the Christ, He is the Son of God, the one who came to teach, to educate, came to offer Himself as a sacrifice. In John chapter 10, He said that He laid down His own life. No man would take it. He willingly offered this sacrifice as a statement of God's love for humanity. Carried into the tomb by friends, brought out of the tomb by His Father. Jesus died so that you and I and all people could have peace with heaven, with God above. God intends that our lives should be wrapped around faithful service to Him. We are a nation and a world that values education. With colleges and universities and all manner of education available, we think of what we have learned to do just in the past 100 years, from putting a person on the moon to sending a rover to Mars, to being able to identify problems that exist within the human body and to devise schemes or manners by which those problems may be addressed and removed. Tremendous knowledge and power as a result, not boundless by any stretch. But we appreciate knowledge and learning. Parents want their children to have opportunities. The government enacts initiatives or programs to make sure that no children are left behind. But my question in thinking about all of this is, are we neglecting the most important education of all? And that is spiritual education and growth. I have a friend who preaches for a congregation here in Texas, and in a meeting one time, and not too long ago in this congregation, there was some discussion about what it is children and younger folks have to do, their various responsibilities. And so someone mentioned, well, the children always have homework. Well, what areas of homework do they have? Well, they have homework in math and in history and in science, all of the usual things that one might mention. But then the preacher asked the question, he said, well, what's missing out of all of this? And so some of the others in the audience said, well, you could add band practice and sports activities and training there, and studying for tests like the SATs and other things that are important. And the preacher stops and says, wait just a minute, that's not what I mean. Where in this discussion of the developmental process of a human being is there a discussion, a broad wholesale discussion of spiritual development? And the people in the meeting said, aha, I understand now what we mean when we say, what's missing? We want to make certain that we grow and imitate Jesus Christ in our lives. In Ephesians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul would say that with knowledge and training, we're no longer tossed about like children, wondering what's right or what's wrong, knowing how to follow God. Instead, he says, with training, we are able to grow up into Him who is the head of all things, even Christ. And so to that end, we speak the truth and we do it out of the motivation of love. Chapter 4 and verse 15. Brethren, all people should appreciate the need and the opportunity that exists from God to be able to learn, to appreciate Him as our Creator, and spend our days in His faithful service. What I would like to do and take just a couple of minutes doing or accomplishing is to discuss some misconceptions or myths that I have heard offered up, I have perhaps offered or thought myself, and maybe you have heard as well, that have to do with perhaps postponing or delaying, or in fact relegating to others completely the need for personal spiritual growth, and for that taking place within the confines of the home. One myth or one statement that's often offered up is by the individual who says, well, I'll worry about Christianity when I'm older. Now, I've heard people say that who are in their teens or their 20s or their 30s. Maybe they think that they haven't yet reached an age where they need to be concerned about religion and the direction their life will take. That's something perhaps we'd suddenly think or inherently think belongs to our parents or to our grandparents or to the older generation. I know that many times people delay committing themselves to that path which they know is right because they want to live their own way through a period of years in their youth. It is unfortunate that so often the 30-somethings end up regretting the things that they did in their 20-somethings or their teen-somethings. Oftentimes, sin makes its way in when people are pushing Christianity away, and they could have avoided those sins if they had been committed to a path of righteousness. When people say later to Christianity, the fact is that later is always out there. It never arrives. That door for such a person is always open. But God does not want us to understand that Christianity is for something later in life. Instead, He wants us to know it is a way of life for the balance of life, the whole of life. Referring back once again to Ecclesiastes 12 in verse number 1, that is why Solomon, looking upon the purpose of life, said in verse number 1, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. Take the opportunities now to make decisions, to build your life around God, to live a prosperous life in His sight, to avoid the pitfalls of sin, the sorrows and the toils and the troubles that come with a life that is devoid of God and His teachings and His influence. Jesus is described in Luke chapter 2 and verse 52 as having increased from His own youth in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and with man. Jesus embodied righteousness throughout all of His life. There's no better example that you and I could follow than the example of Jesus the Christ. We also know that if we delay and suppose that at some future date, not only will our resolve likely weaken, not only will our ties to the world strengthen, we get caught in habits. We lay foundations of practices that are often very difficult to break. In Ephesians 2, in verse number 3, Paul speaks about those Christians in Ephesus. He said, we once walked in the ways of the world. In fact, he said there in verse number 3, we were by nature children of wrath. The word nature there doesn't mean that we were born sinful. In fact, it means that we were by long-standing practice or habit children of wrath. Through the course of our years, we lay down habits, associations, ties. And if they're not ones that promote righteousness and link us more closely to God, then they are instead taking us further away from Him, and it is increasingly difficult to break those ties. It's harder to turn back to God. Don't let anyone here today, or don't let anyone that you may have the power to influence, go away from our presence or from your presence with the idea that it's okay to postpone thoughts of spiritual life. Today is the day of salvation. Now is the time to draw near to God. A second myth that comes out is individuals, perhaps a couple, who says that when the children come along, then we'll take Christianity serious, or when our children are perhaps a bit older so that they can be involved too, then we'll take Christianity seriously. If that's the case, I have to ask the question, is the relationship between the parent with God, or is it with the children? Is it mediated through children? Does it suddenly take on more significance because there are children in the picture? And again, we'll have habits that have developed through that time period, lost opportunities to help other people, to go about doing good as Jesus did, Acts 10:38. When we read the very simple statement of Romans 12:2, Paul says that we are no longer to be conformed to the pattern, the habit, the form of this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And he doesn't say just to do that at some future time or when there are little eyes watching. It is something to be pursued now at this particular time. The fact is that we cannot teach our children, we can't teach others that which we don't know. A person may be able to teach beyond their own experiences. Paul have no indication of certainty that he was married or had children. But in his epistles, by the wisdom of God, the knowledge of God, he is able to write about how husbands and wives should behave to one another, parents and children, masters and slaves. You see, Paul could teach beyond his own experiences because he had the knowledge or wisdom from God. But a person can never, never teach beyond their own education. If we're preparing to be good at some point in future in the life of another person, we need to be good now. We need to be learning and growing now so that we can represent God in our lives and show Him to others. A third myth, perhaps, or misconception, is when someone suggests that Christianity is really for women and for children. Just a few years ago, a man in the state of Michigan was arrested for violating a particular law. This law was established in 1897, and it prohibited the cursing in front of children. Well, the man was paddling in his canoe in Rifle River. The canoe turned over. He fell out of the canoe, fell into the water, and came up out of the water cursing, stream of profanities. Just over on the side was a woman, a mother, and her two children. And there was a sheriff's deputy over there as well. Said the tirade went on for about 3 minutes. Immediately arrested him and took him, and he was to stand trial. If convicted, he faced 90 days in jail and up to a $100 fine. And you can imagine that the argument went over the issue of free speech. Could he say these things? What I want us to think about is why it is that in 1897 or 1997 or 2004, a law would have to be enacted that says it's wrong to curse in front of children, but it's okay in front of perhaps ladies and certainly in front of men. I suppose the idea is that real men don't need God. Real men don't need principles of goodness and morality and ethics. Real men don't need to pursue righteousness. Christianity is just for children, right? What does it take to make a real man? To be a solid, stalwart individual? Was Jesus any less of a real man because he honored God with his life? He said in John chapter 8, "My Father is always with me because I always do those things that please him." When we read about the man Abraham, Genesis 18 and verse 19, and I know this verse will be quoted often through the course of this week, God is speaking there about Abraham, and he says, "I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, so that the Lord may bring on Abraham that which he hath spoken of him." God says, "I have blessings to give this man, this patriarch, and I will do so because he's a godly man." Was Abraham not a real man? How about Ezra? Described in chapter 7 of the book bearing his name, verse number 10. It says that Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord, to be a student of God's ways, to do it, that is, to do the law of the Lord, and then to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. Ezra was a real man. Brethren, what would God say constitutes a stable, upright, mature human being? It's a person who loves him and has committed their life to following him. The last myth that I will mention, number 4, some might suggest that the church will take care of the spiritual education and growth needs. Perhaps a parent, I have three small children myself, perhaps a parent may say, well, I'll let the children learn in Bible classes. That will meet their needs. I will learn in Bible classes. I'm a willing attendee. But I ask the question, how many hours a week does that really constitute in our schedule? Just a few? Is that really the amount of time and the amount of involvement necessary to establish and maintain a relationship with our Creator? Would that work with our spouses? Would it work with our employers? Would it work with our children? The reality is that the home is the place where the deepest lessons at the earliest age take root. And every day, children in homes watch the primary actors on their life television screen. Those primary actors are mother and father, and the various other figures who move in and out of their lives. That television is on for them to view from the time they rise to the time that they go to bed at night, and those lessons are deeply ingrained. Art Linkletter had his very popular and very funny program in the 50s and 60s. Brought the children on and asked them questions, and what he was doing was prompting discussion. It allowed the children to show what they were exposed to at home and gave everyone a chance to chuckle or laugh, and the parents perhaps a moment to be embarrassed. The reality is children are just recorders. They take in and they replay what they've seen. The home is where those lessons are learned most fully, most completely, most enduringly. It isn't the church, although the church is certainly very important. What happens then when the home is not what it ought to be? The children are learning the lessons, they're just learning the wrong ones. And so when they mature and grow, they probably will reflect those lessons in their own lives in a cycle, a pattern of imitation is essentially developed and progresses. We've got to do better than that. Surely greater things can be achieved than that. I'm reminded of the individual Timothy. Paul would write to him in the book of 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. And when he speaks there, he speaks very favorably about this young man and his family. He speaks there and he says that he's joyous when he says, when I recall or call to remembrance the unfeigned faith, the very sincere faith that is in thee, Timothy, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois, and with thy mother Eunice, and he says, I am persuaded that is in thee also. Isn't it very interesting that Paul does not mention the preacher of the local congregation where Timothy may have attended in his youth? He doesn't mention a particular Bible class teacher. Although I know that the brethren were certainly important, they're pictured as being alongside Timothy in Acts chapter 16, beginning in verse 1. But what he says is, I recognize what was in your grandmother and in your mother. I recognize that in you. And then later in chapter 3, he would say, you learned the scriptures from the time that you were a babe. Brethren, the home has its responsibilities for training and development of the individual to reflect Christ and God in our particular lives. None of these myths should be entertained by any of us because they are destructive. People who succumb to these temptations, these ideas, mistaken thoughts, they suffer the consequences in their own lives. And how many times years later may say, what happened? Where did we go wrong? Ladies and gentlemen, we are created by God, and we are intended to be God's people. We're intended to think of ourselves that way. Americans, Texans perhaps, those are distant seconds, thirds, and so on from the identity of being one of God's children. And the need to listen to our Father and the counsel that He provides on how to order our lives, everything about our existence, and to look past today to what can be just down the road, well down the road, and even into eternity. Do we look that far? Are we thinking about eternity? God is. God has our future in mind. I'd like to ask you to look with me in the book of Matthew chapter 7 for just a moment. Matthew chapter 7, as we come to the close of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus has offered this sermon, perhaps one of the greatest single teaching episodes in all of human history. And when he comes to the close of this sermon, chapter 7 of Matthew, beginning in verse number 24, his concern is that people would take the message and apply it. It's never been the case that human beings haven't been touched by God or haven't had his revelation available. It's always the issue of the desire to utilize God's instructions. And so, beginning in verse number 24, Jesus says, "Therefore, whosoever heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them, I will liken him to a wise man which built his house upon a rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell not, for it was founded upon a rock. And everyone that heareth these sayings of mine and doeth them not shall be likened unto a foolish man or person, which built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it." How many times have families, individuals, households been subjected to the terrors of sin, to sorrow that comes, to the disappointment, the sadness, and regret, what might have been? And Jesus says, take the words that I offer and live by them, follow them, build your house, your life, upon the rock. It need not be the case that people suffer sorrow and disappointment within their homes because they have left God behind or never invited him past the marriage ceremony. What I would like to do for the next few minutes is make a few practical suggestions about what you and I may do to help our homes to be a place where we mature spiritually, where we grow, and we more fully reflect Jesus Christ living within us. I speak first of all to the adults, and although I've mentioned marriage, by no means should we say that the home consists just in the situation of a man and woman having been married or having children. I know of individuals in this audience, single, living perhaps with friends or roommates. God has a plan for your home too. These are not future instructions. These are right now plans that God has for you and for me. So the first thing I would say to all adults here today is to pursue your own spiritual education and growth. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 14 talks about having our senses exercised to tell the difference, to discern between good and evil. Are you learning? Are you growing? I realize that in this auditorium there are people from many different backgrounds and of many different levels of spiritual knowledge and growth. But you know, we can all be in the process of learning. And even the new Christian has the foundation perhaps being established and the conversion that has occurred, but there's a need for continued growth and encouragement, understanding and maturity. And you may be such an individual today who knows that you need to continue to learn and to mature, but you're not exactly certain what course to pursue to make that a reality. Well, let me suggest, if nothing else, talk to the elders of the congregation where you worship. Talk to the person who is the evangelist, preaches there. The persons who have been teaching Bible class or who have knowledge and wisdom, as you can see. Ask them what you can do. Allow them to be a resource for you so that you can make certain that on a daily basis you are interacting with God's instruction book, His Word, that you talk to Him daily, that you praise Him daily, and that on a daily basis you try and exhibit the qualities of righteousness. As well, for children, if there are children in your home, allow them to see that this growth and training is important. Children may be watching, and the habits that mother and father have are the habits that they will first emulate or practice. Allow them to see righteousness pursued and developed. I would also say, have in your home a time of study or devotion on a daily basis or a regular basis. If you have small children, I will say this. I would, in some ways, rather teach high school ages and up as I work with the congregation, because I'm dealing with persons who are much closer to the intellectual level, the cognitive development level that I'm at, and it's easier to talk on a common level. I appreciate very much individuals who work with small children, who take those bundles of energy and try to shape and focus their thinking, allow them to pick up the lessons that they can and they will. If you have small children and you're not certain about how you should spend your week, each night perhaps, studying at home and worshiping God at home with your children, if you're not certain what to do, I refer you back to the congregation. Talk to the eldership. Talk to the preacher. You might go to the class where your children attend on Sunday morning or Wednesday evening in Vacation Bible School. Ask what they do. Know what to expect from your children as they're learning and growing. Know what you need to provide for them. And if you need help, perhaps devising a plan or an approach or a curriculum, ask for help, because such teaching is probably already going on in the place where you worship. And I will say, from experience and observation as well, that the better attuned the members in a family can be to what they need to learn and how they can learn, the more likely that there will be a great enjoyment, great pleasure, great success, much less frustration, much less disappointment. Worship God on a daily basis. Draw close to Him, and He'll draw close to you. I would also say, as we come to a close, that I would encourage you to build a library in your home. Garages are filled with weight sets, perhaps covered with cobwebs, exercise bicycles that may or may not get use. We're concerned with physical health and well-being, and that's fine. But in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 8, the text says that bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable unto all things in this life and that which is to come. In your home, you may have dictionaries and encyclopedias. I encourage you to find out what books you can add so that you will have a rich spiritual library as well, whether it's concordances, dictionaries, encyclopedias, books of maps and illustrations, commentaries, or instructive works by faithful brethren. Consider putting those things in your life and in your family's life so that you can learn and grow. And then, as it says in James 1:22, don't just put them on the shelf, being a hearer, but be a doer. Study, learn, and practice. You'll notice this week that there are exhibitors and rooms set up where many of these resources are offered to you. Take advantage of it. Take some time to think about how your home can be more active spiritually and supporting strength and growth there and also the local congregation. Brethren, as we come to a close, I remind us Psalm 127 in verse number 1. Except the Lord build the house. I can perform wedding ceremonies and I can sign the paperwork so that two people may establish a home. But the fact is that except the Lord build the house, they that build it labor in vain. None of us will have the home, the life, the future that we hope for and we long for unless our lives are built squarely around Jesus the Christ. You and I need to be the wise persons of whom Jesus spoke, hearing His words and putting them into practice. That's a real person in God's sight. That's a person who is mature. It may be that we have in our good crowd this morning someone who is not a Christian. You may have heard lessons, you may have read materials, and you may understand what it takes to become a Christian. Hearing the words of truth from God's holy writ, knowing that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, the Messiah, who came and offered His life so that you and I might be at peace with God. You may well know that it calls upon you to repent and to change or adjust your life to live for God's purposes, not your own, anymore. And you may well know that it includes being baptized, immersed, so that you may have your sins washed away by the blood of Jesus the Christ. If you've never done that, but you've contemplated this step, let me encourage you to prepare for the future right now, to make right now your moment to say yes to this opportunity of graciousness and goodness from God. Let the sacrifice of Jesus mean something particularly to your life and allow yourself to be born again and counted a part of God's spiritual family. Perhaps we have someone here who has forgotten that they were ever cleansed from their old sins. Perhaps we have someone who needs the prayers and encouragement of this body of Christians. We want you to know that we all stand before God as people who He loves and whom He wants to be with Him for eternity. And we encourage one another along that path. If we can help you this morning to pray for you, to give any counsel or advice or encouragement, to be useful in any way, we want you to know that our goal, our singular goal, is to glorify God now and to pass on to the glories of heaven. We extend this time of invitation as we stand and sing this invitation song in just a moment. We want you to know that if we can help you at all to begin to put your life on the right track behind the cross of Jesus Christ, we want to be your servant. We want to help you to do that. And so we invite you to come down to the front and tell us how we may be of use to you as you turn your life over to God. If we can help you this morning, won't you please come and tell us how while we stand and while we sing.